Thank you so much for inviting me, for being here, for sharing with you all my own journey and in my own attempts to love, in my own anxiousness and eagerness to love. And what I'd like to do, if it's okay, is actually lead us in a song. And it's a call and response song. So we're gonna go through it twice, and then we're gonna divide the room, and we'll do it in rounds. Okay? So this is how it goes. And bear with me, I'm not much of a singer. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here. Gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. Spirit, draw near. So we'll go through it one more time, okay? Gathered here in the mystery of the hour. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour. Gathered here in one strong body. Gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near, Spirit, draw near. So I'm going to invite Dennis to come up, and I will take this side, and we'll start, and then this side will echo, okay? Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. Spirit, draw near. Thank you. So, Richard Rohr has actually walked with me now for several years. I've been a huge fan of his, and I've tried to read most every book he's written, and he's the one who accompanies me on my retreats and all. And so when I was invited to share reflections on some of his words, oh God, I was so touched, you know, because he is such a mentor. And I realized that I can't really add more to his genius. I feel like he is a genius. I think the best I could do is try to reflect with my own life what his words have meant, how I've tried to incorporate them, and how I see them through really the prism of my life, that as a dear friend told me, my life is not about me. Our life is not about us, right? It's we are the instrument that St. Francis speaks to. So I want to begin in sharing my stories back in high school for me, really. I did grow up in a Latino family, and I grew up really with a lot of the Catholic piety that maybe many of you all grew up with. And so it was the Sunday church going, the praying the rosaries, the the all of what Catholicism meant. And to be honest, it was very moving, even for me at a young age. I remember I went to Catholic school, and I remember sitting during lunch recesses in the church, because it was really the only place of quiet, and I just wanted to kind of think about things. So I did go to a Catholic elementary school and then a Catholic high school. The Catholic high school was actually pretty conservative. It was ran by the Felician Sisters in Southern California. And they, of course, still had their habits. And I remember sitting in senior year in my religion class, and it was New Testament taught by Sister Margaret. And Sister Margaret started talking, and it was actually the 800th anniversary of St. Francis's life. But the way she spoke of St. Francis was so curious, because she almost spoke of him as this figure that had existed long ago, and it was almost a sadness in her heart, because that St. Francis wasn't around anymore, and really not too many people following in his footsteps. I think she might have even been indicting herself. I don't know, but there was a certain sadness, and I remember picking up on that. It wasn't long after that I was watching a PBS program, and it was about Thomas Merton, and I had never heard of Thomas Merton. I'd kind of only gotten the big saints, unfortunately, in high school. I never heard of Dorothy Day. I never heard of Thomas Merton. They sort of tended towards those older saints. So I looked at this program almost in disbelief. I knew there were monasteries. I knew there were monks, but it was something so far from my experience. And it was something about Thomas Merton that just, it attracted me. And it was an abandonment of all the things worldly. And he had glimpses of something more that he gave himself to. And he surrendered everything to God in the hope of finding something intangible. He did this and entered a community, and he dedicated his life to prayer. And so there was this sort of this ideas that kept coming up in me, like, what does this mean? And what does St. Francis mean? And what does Thomas Merton mean? And how does one try to live that at age 18? So with a little bit of, or a lot of zealous, I actually invited a friend from school to go with me on Good Friday to try and live what Jesus had told us. We had to feed the poor. We had to be around the poor. So my friend and I set out to Los Angeles, downtown LA, and we sort of literally just had a bag of bread or bags of bread with us and a desire to serve the hungry. We got off on Los Angeles Street, and there, almost immediately, we see this little crowd of people and this huge sign, and there was, I could see women who had veils on, and so I thought, Catholic. And I saw that there might be a couple of men who had the priest garb on, and I thought, Catholic. And then there was this huge sign, and the sign read, "Today, Jesus is crucified in Central America." What the heck is this about? So I told my friend, pull over. We got to find out what this is about. So she did, and we pulled over. We got close to it, and it turns out that on this particular Good Friday, this group of people were praying the Stations of the Cross in front of the federal building. And then I'm really, really taken, because what does the Stations of the Cross have to do with a federal building, and who are these people? Well, by the time I realized it, the banner was folded, a van pulled up, a lot of people got into the van, whisked away, and there we were standing. And I didn't know what hit me. Really, literally didn't know what hit me. And soon after, this homeless-looking man came, and I thought, bingo, we can give the bread to him. This is who we came for, right? But actually, he said, I haven't seen you guys here before. Where do you come from? And I go to the story, and I say, but we have bread for you. He says, I don't need bread. And I said, wait, what do you mean? And he said, no, these are the people I live with. You don't know them. And I said, no, I've never seen them a day in my life. And so he said, let me go introduce you to them. So he did not realize that we had driven. And so he said, come with me. And we sort of thought that it was going to be a short distance, but it really wasn't. It was actually through Skid Row to the other edge of town. It would probably be about 2 miles. And here are two young women, very naive, going through Skid Row, only really wanted to give bread. So he walks us to the soup kitchen, which is where he lived. He lived on the top floor of the soup kitchen. And he said, I want to introduce you to Julie. So Julie, in fact, came to the door, and she welcomed us. And she was actually preparing a meal. And she was preparing a meal for the guests who lived upstairs, all of whom were homeless, mentally ill, and very fragile, fragile people who she invited us to go meet. And so it was around the time to eat, and she said, why don't you stay? I'd love to have you stay. And I said, oh no, it's Good Friday, I'm fasting. And she said, would Jesus fast or would he eat with the poor? And yeah, busted, exactly. I did feel busted, right? So I sat and ate with the poor. I didn't give them bread. I ate among them. And let me just say, because it was such a sort of pious Catholic upbringing, we kind of had to hardcore fast. So, it was not eating anything, but then, making sure that you were kind of a little bit miserable. You know, you had to sort of sit in church and all of that. So, Julia, the menu on Good Friday was shrimp. And shrimp was a big thing in my family because we were an immigrant family and didn't grow up with a lot of money. So shrimp was a big thing. So here we were eating shrimp with the poor on Good Friday. Only God. So it was sort of this plunging in that really started my experiment. There was a sign there that was inviting people who came through to participate in a summer internship program with the Los Angeles Catholic Worker. And so I did. I said, God, what a great experience to live with this community, to enter into the life. And it's curious because I remember one of the things that I had heard Thomas Merton talk about. They were sort of taking clips when they did this PBS special. It was something that said that when he entered the monastery, it was like a coming home. It was a coming home for him. And I must say that when I entered into the Catholic Worker, it was a coming home because there was a simplicity there as well as a spirituality there, and finally the two came together. Very, very meaningful. I lived through that internship and it sort of like every minute of every day it was just like things coming in and oh my God, you know, as one is tend to be when one is 18, right? So, but I'd already signed up. I'd signed up for college. And so I did my summer internship. I went to my first semester of college. And while sitting in the classrooms this first semester, and while listening, just realizing, like, oh my God, you know, life, there is only one life, and these years are so important because these years are formative in the life of any of us. And these are the years that often set the trajectory of where your life will go. We all have that, right? And so for many, it's college or convent or seminary. And it became clear that who and where I needed to learn the things that my life would be about weren't going to come from sitting in college, but had to go back to being at the Catholic Worker. And so with a great sense of inner freedom, really, I dropped out of college. And, you know, my mom, it was difficult for her, you know, because that was where her thought and her trajectory for me was. But for me, it really was a calling, a vocation. And so I joined full-time into the Catholic Worker, and full-time is actually time and a half at the LA Catholic Worker, because you have a soup kitchen, you have medical clinic, you have a three-story house of hospitality, and you have 15 guests, and it's a kind of a go-go-go that when you're young, you have all the energy for, and I had the energy and I had the zealousness. But more than just the work, for me, it was the people. And so I knew that because I had left college, the people that were going to teach me were going to be my teachers, my professors. And so it's these people who I'd like to share their story today. And the first person I want to bring up is Antonia. And Antonia and Rodolfo themselves were refugees from Central America, the Central America that we had stood by at the federal building. And they were actually just a few years older than myself, but already had two kids, one on the way. Because of the crisis, or the boom of people fleeing Central America at the time, the places where they ended up actually ended up being on Skid Row. There were no houses, apartments, anything available to them because of the masses. So they ended up staying in what's called SROs, single room occupancy hotels, right? And many of these hotels just riddled with drug addiction, cockroaches, filth, stench. It was horrible. Antonia would bring her daughters to the clinic. They had cockroaches in their ears. I learned how to take cockroaches out of kids' ears. It was Antonia and her husband Rodolfo waiting for the bus one day on Skid Row when there actually was a drive-by shooting. And Rodolfo, the husband, just instinctively put out his shoulder to sort of, you know, hide his daughters. And the bullet came into Rodolfo's shoulder and lodged itself into his spinal cord, and he was instantly paralyzed from the waist down. So here's a young woman, two kids, one on the way, paralyzed husband, and get a call one day, and she said what had happened, and said, you know, the social workers told me to call my church. And so that's why I'm calling you. And, you know, I just, Tom and I were talking a little bit the other day, and you know, I was thinking about what Pope Francis has just said regarding the refugees, the onslaught of refugees that are coming, that are risking so much, and saying to all of us, we have to be church for them. He's saying to monasteries and convents and seminaries and any place that has a room, open it for them. These are ours. We are together in this. So, interesting that Antonia, almost 30 years ago, and Pope Francis kind of were on the same page. Another professor of mine, during my time at the Catholic Worker, was a man named LaDon Sheets. And LaDon Sheets was one of these what we call itinerant workers. He went from community to community, just offering to help, plugging in where he could. And this time he had come to Los Angeles. I'd heard a lot about him, but finally I was able to meet him, and finally I was able to hear from him his story, which was really incredible. LaDon had been the vice president of sales at IBM in the late 60s. He had made it. He had the house in Tiburon. He had the house in New York. He jet-setted. He had lands. He had property. He also had a deep yearning to understand the life of Jesus. And so he started himself this process, this journey of what does that mean? And his conclusion was he had to let it all go. And he did. And he left his job, left all of his belonging, sold it all, and ended up living out of a backpack exclusively. We often told LaDon that he looked like a picture because he literally only had like two shirts. And so anytime you saw him, it was much like the time you saw him before. So he went from Catholic worker houses to monasteries for renewal, and actually what was most important to him and his own calling was actually praying at the sites where nuclear weapons are stored. And so he would, as simple as climb over the fence, kneel and pray, often be apprehended by the military police, and then he'd often be put away for a year in prison. And so it was while he was in prison at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles is actually where I met him. And it turns out I had the great fortune of being on the visitors list because everybody else had just gotten arrested for having protested at the federal building. So it was me who was lucky enough to go in and sit with LaDon in prison and start listening to his stories. One of the things that impressed me most about him was his insistence on the discipline of prayer. And Catholic workers often, as you all might know, tend to be more on the doing than the being of human beingness, right? And so to have somebody say, no, wait a minute, prayer needs to be the bedrock, is really, it was, again, reminding me, this is what Merton said, right? LaDon called his life really an experiment with truth. And it was many, many years later that LaDon was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And Dennis and I had invited him to come to our home and die with us. And it was really quite memorable the evening that we were gathered together because it was a community that formed around him. He had made so many friends in the experiment, and many of them were wanting to come and share with us this experience of offering hospice. And so it was while we were gathered in prayer one evening, and we read the gospel where Peter is reminding Jesus that they'd left everything to follow him. And Jesus, in turn, reminded Peter that they'd gain much more for doing so. And Ladan, in just such a poignant and tender moment, said that the experiment had proved to be true. That he had given up everything, and yet he was dying surrounded by love and utter gratitude for the gift of his life. And Richard Rohr, in speaking of Francis and Claire, said, "They lost and let go of all fear of suffering, all need for power, prestige, and possessions, and all need for their small self to be important. And they came out the other side knowing something essential, who they really were in God, and thus who they really were." So it's the spiritual journey really is a coming to know who we really are, who we really are. Ladan had a lot of he was Texan actually, and he even had a little drawl, and he had a lot of sayings, and one of his favorites, and one that is with me constantly, and has really helped in, again, just keeping me on that trajectory, is you become like that which you are habitually with. You become like that which you are habitually with. And his habit was, of course, to be with the suffering in the world, but also to be in silence and to be in beauty. And Ladan taught me to open my eyes to the color of flowers, to counting the number of seagulls that were flying overhead. He was really a perfectionist, something I'm not. But he opened my eyes in ways that I really hadn't known. And so after 5 years at the Los Angeles Catholic Worker, I left the Catholic Worker to spend a year at a monastery. And it's a monastery in Northern California. And I think for me it was a time to just be able to consider, reflect on, pray about what I had lived. And where I was to go next, and what was I to do next. It was trying to have my authority be built on bedrock and not on sand. Okay? So I learned the way of silence and meditation, and I reflected for a year on the, as the sisters said, the hidden life of Jesus. And the place of his experience of belovedness, because it was from that experience that he and Francis and all mystics and saints manifest God. So the belovedness of Jesus came at his baptism, right? It's the first time that he became aware of who he really was. And from that place was thrown to the desert and then the ministry. But we really need to come to understand that place of belovedness. Ladan understood it. Mystics understand it. It's the spiritual journey. because I was in the monastery, I was also had the privilege of having time to read. And the two books that most touched me while I was there was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship. And he talked about something called cheap grace. And God, there was something in me that, you know, kind of had an understanding, hadn't really quite lived it, but understood something of it. The other book I read was Thomas Merton's The Seeds of Contemplation. Again, so I had these two books, you know, this radical action and this radical prayer, and trying to bring them together. And though the contemplative life was quite appealing, I knew that it wasn't where I was to live my life. That it informed me, that it nourished me, that in many ways it sustained me, but it wasn't to be the life I was to live day in and day out. And so, I came back into the world, but not with a young, zealous energy, but with a rooted desire to serve. And as Rohr says, it's the authority that comes from a deeper place and a more convincing place. It's the, instead of I have a right to say this, it feels more like I've earned the right to say it, right? I've earned it because I've been putting in the work. I've been listening, and therefore I can speak. And isn't that what Jesus did with the deaf man? That he heals the deaf man, and somehow in the healing of his ears, he is able to speak. So as we hear, we then, and observe and listen, we're able to then speak. And so I knew I would come back to Los Angeles, but I came back not to work at the Catholic Worker, but instead to work as a chaplain at County Hospital. And this was quite unique, this experience, because it was clearly being a doing with the poor, but it wasn't a doing in offering things, it was a doing of listening. And so trying to listen and be with the awesome suffering that happens to the people that are at County Hospital. I met a woman there named Lisa Venke. She was a patient. And what was unique about Lisa was that she was Polish, had just arrived from Poland, and she spoke all of about 5 words of English. And I spoke of Polish. But she had a Polish-English dictionary on the table, and when I tried to, you know, show her who I was and what I wanted to offer, I wanted to offer communion, I wanted to offer to sit with her, she pulled out the Polish dictionary, and honest to God, almost looking word for word for a sentence to be formed, and in my own great desire to be present to her, I got to know her story. And her story, without going into too much detail, but her story was, you know, she was in the hospital because she had metastatic ovarian cancer, and literally she was gray from the chemotherapy that she was receiving. I'd never seen anybody gray in my life. And she was, because at this stage in her life, they gave her a very short prognosis of life, she wanted to kind of go through and process some of the things in her life, including her you know, abusive husband, the pain of not being with her parents, but also the big wound for her was not having had children. And so it was in this sort of like place of trying to figure out that she was sent home. She invited me to come to her house and to have her sister make pierogies, which is, you know, a delicious German dish, or rather Polish dish. And so would I bring her communion? Absolutely. So drive to her sister's house, who was just as warm and loving as she was, and they fed me pierogies, and after dinner, she said, would you please give me communion? So I gave her communion, and before the final prayer, she gets out of her nightstand two shot glasses and a bottle of vodka, and she pours them both, and she gives each to me, one to me and one to her, and she toasts, and she says, to life, to love, amen, amen. And that was our final prayer together. I went home that night. The sister called me the following day. She died that night, and she said she was peaceful. You know, just what a way to die, to life, to love. Amen, amen. Rohr says that God's presence first hides, and yet ironically is also revealed in such seeming and total absence, but only for those who search and ask. And I think death often hastens, right, the searching and the asking. Yes, it does. So it was during this time at being a chaplain at the county hospital that I met Dennis. And Dennis was another chaplain there, another lay chaplain. And we became debriefing partners. And, you know, our experiences at the hospital were so intense that we debrief on a weekly basis and, you know, just trying to grapple with the powerlessness that comes so often in sitting with people who are powerless themselves. And so that's the solidarity, right? You are powerless to help. They are powerless in their suffering. And that's a solidarity. But that's something that is heavy. And so we would come together weekly. That then actually became more than weekly. It became, bi-weekly. We really have to debrief. And we fell in love. Yeah, right. We did fall in love. And it was during this experience of falling in love with one another, but being with the people and talking about the people, and we came up with this phrase that called the people Beatitude people. These were the Beatitude people that Jesus, who himself was a Beatitude person, he lived with, he walked with, he ate with. These were the people that Jesus chose to be around. And how could our love and our lives together reflect this renewed understanding? Okay, so we wanted our life to come together. We didn't want to come together to just procreate, though that also was part of it. But we wanted to come together and have our love, our experience together, reflect our understanding. And so we left Los Angeles, and through a series of miracles, some of whom are in this very room today, we ended up in Guadalupe, a little farm working community in northern Santa Barbara County, and we founded Beatitude House. And, you know, I know a lot of you know that, you know, it is a farm working community, and as such, there are a lot of needs. And when we arrived in Guadalupe, we almost set out like, you know, the Mormons. We kind of didn't have a lot of money. In fact, we only had $300 to our name. So we parked the car not wanting to waste gas, and we rode our bikes. And we'd ride our bikes around the town and talking to the people, talking to the community, what are the needs? Is there a need for more services? Is there a need for something like what we'd like to do here? And we kept getting affirmatives. Yes, please come. So We took the $300 and then a little bit of money coming in from here, coming in from there, people who really just wanted to support us, knew what we were about, and we were able to move into and rent an old Victorian house. The owners, it turns out, knew the priest that we worked for at County Hospital. And so we said, you know, we don't have jobs. We don't have a lot of money. Would you be willing, please, to let us do our ministry from your house? And they said, of course. We can't give it to you free. Can you pay rent for $450? Yes, we can. Thank you very much. Grace, grace upon grace. And so we moved in. We didn't have much. In fact, we had only our blow-up bed and just a couple of things. We must have eaten more watermelon than anything, and tuna sandwiches. We ate that for months and months. We didn't have a lot of money. And so we were there, and the miracle continued to unfold. Word got around that we were in the community, that we were wanting to serve the community. And so not only were we helping, you know, the people that came directly to us, but then we also started getting calls. And we got calls from social workers. And social workers would call and say, you know, I have this problem person. And I figured out very, very soon that problem always meant undocumented. Because there were no or very few programs for undocumented people. And so one such person that came very early on was this call, and it was Sylvia. And it turns out that Sylvia, herself a farm worker, with 8 children under the age of 13, and had been found to have had metastatic breast cancer. Could we help? We sure could. So, excuse me. So, go to Sylvia's house. You know, what need isn't there in a house that has 8 children under the age of 13? Her husband was abusive, and she has metastatic breast cancer. What need isn't there, right? So there were so many needs that it overwhelmed me. And we're new in the community, and I'm trying to reach out. I'm trying to figure out what other resources there were. I get on the phone and call a place, and I kid you not, your problem solved, Incorporated. Great. I kid you not. Your problem solved. So I get on the phone. I talk to your problem solved person. I say, look, here's a woman with 8 kids. She has metastatic breast cancer. Can you help? And they said, absolutely. Like, they're almost waiting for the call, right? Like, yes, we want to help. Your problem solved. And then it kind of, The conversation, of course, keeps going, and somehow it comes out, oh, she's undocumented. We can't solve your problem, because your problem is beyond what we can solve. So, I must admit, I was very angry. And I said that. And I said it in a way that she understood I was very angry, and I hung up the phone. And realized that that is the plight of the undocumented that continues to be lived, right, again and again in our communities. Something to note. I realized also that we weren't just about feeding the poor, trying to feed the poor, or clothe, or we were trying to live in a sacramental way, right? So what we were trying to do was to be present to the births and baptisms and weddings and celebrations and graduations, as well as the divorces and the drug addictions and the deaths of these people. And guess what? We weren't ordained. We weren't ordained. But we, all of us, were trying to be church for one another. So I suppose, you know, with these stories, one can, you know, sort of get into this idea that it was all easy and that it was, you know, just kind of laid before us. But it wasn't. It really wasn't. And I want to talk a little bit about the struggles, because it's really only through the struggles and the suffering that then we come back to our utter need for God's mercy and love. And so, I don't know. We'd been in Guadalupe for, I don't know, maybe 10, 11 years at this point. And, you know, we had started these projects, and we had had two kids, pretty close together. We were fortunate to have another Catholic worker purchase a house for us to live apart from the Catholic worker, which was really helpful given that we had these two kids. And we were going a mile a minute because there was so much to do and so many needs to attend to, and the kids. And it was Advent, and actually Christmas time, for whatever reason, tends to be really, really busy. And so it was Advent, and we have the custom to, with the children, do Advent prayer. And it's a beautiful tradition that we've had of turning out the lights and doing and singing together. And anyways, we were just finishing with this, and we were getting ready to get our pajamas on, and I see a note slip under the door, and it was a note from my 6-year-old son, Thomas. And Thomas wrote in his perfect first grade penmanship on this paper, "Where is your joy, sad face?" Where is your joy, sad face? That's a little bit indicting. When your 6-year-old son can say, "Where is your joy?" And I just have to say, our joy becomes elusive when we get into this idea of being in control, of everything resting on us, of taking on more than what is due us. So he was being, for me, for us at the time, really a mentor. My son as a mentor, calling back to where is our joy. Dorothy Day calls it the duty of delight. And so it began the process of discovering the truth of Mother Teresa's words about not having to do a lot, but instead do a few things with a lot of love. Rohr speaks to simplicity as the process of not needing or desiring anything in particular. For us, that meant letting go of situations that take us from more than we can give in the moment with our time or energy. It also had us realize the utter need to practice detachment from solutions to problems that may or may not be found by us. So the only real way to practice this detachment is through prayer. Because what greater way really can one detach than by sitting in a stance of prayer and saying, as Romero said, "I cannot, you must. I cannot, you must." That's the edge of the inside, I think, that Rohr talks about. He says it's a move to the laboratory where all such radical change can occur inside of our very mind, heart, and I love the cells of our body. It is contemplative practice which rewires our inner life and actually confirms in the soul a kind of emotional sobriety, plus an inner sense of divine union. So we're back to that belovedness. My belovedness is not by what I do. My belovedness is. If anything, my belovedness can only reflect back to God in my actions. The experience of divine union then offers one a certain clarity to see with new eyes and understand in new ways the resurrection that only comes after death. We can't put the cart before the horse, right? We gotta die, and God doesn't hurt. Is that it? Okay, great. So I just want to just finish by saying that over the years there's been a little bit of a wounding in stating that I don't have a college degree. But I just want to say that in a sense I have a PhD. And it's in life. And today, and this talking and this invitation has been a sharing my thesis. And the thesis, I wrote it down. If I may, I'm going to just say the thesis, because it's this. Love's boundless power transforms each of our lives. And that's it. Thank you. Thank you.